This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Welcome back to A Complete History of Manchester United. I'm your host, Wayne Barton, author and producer of several Manchester United books and films, joined as always on this journey by the legendary football writer, Paddy Barclay, author of several biographies, three of former Manchester United managers, obviously the biography of Matt Busby, which is masterful, the definitive tome, and the biography of Alex Ferguson, Football Bloody Hell, and... Is it Anatomy of a Winner, the Jose Mourinho one?
Yes, that's right. God, that was a while ago, but Anatomy of a Winner, yes. It's a guide to the early life of Jose Mourinho, yes.
Yeah, great insight as well, a fantastic book. All three of them are fantastic, obviously, and all three definitive in their own ways as well. We are going through this journey of Old Trafford history. This stop takes us through the 1976-77 season, which is quite eventful. If you are watching the video, please give it a like and subscribe on YouTube. Join in the conversation in the comments section. If you're listening back on the audio podcast, please be sure to subscribe and give us a review on the platform you are listening on. Right, Manchester United back in the top flight. They finished third. They lost in the FA Cup final to Southampton. But teams were now treating this Manchester United side very seriously. They were very young team, but they were playing a very flamboyant style of football. Not exactly the Busby way, but a team that were playing the Doherty way. What do you think, Paddy, would have been the objective for United going into this season?
76-7. Well, I think they would have wanted to consolidate that league position. Liverpool were the team to beat. Liverpool, now managed by Bob Paisley, who'd been the assistant to Bill Shankly when the modern Liverpool was rebuilt. So the United wanted to remain competitive, but that FA Cup final defeat, that rankled. So the FA Cup was another very firm priority. United are back in Europe. They're in what's now the Europa League. That was what they earned as the prize for finishing third in the previous season. So it's a big season with a lot of priorities. But yeah, that FA Cup final defeat to a second division club, Southampton, yeah, definitely would have rankled. The aim was a trophy. You know, Manchester United had to be back in open top bus territory. That would be the priority.
Yeah, there are a couple of players still in the squad who'd had a lot of semi-final near misses. Alex Stepney would have remembered those under Wilf McGuinness. Sammy McElroy definitely remembered the one with Norwich when we had him on the on the podcast. He was still fuming about that one. Yeah. So Norwich in the League Cup in 1975, and obviously the near miss of getting to Wembley and losing to Southampton in 76. Reminiscent somewhat of the Busby side in the 1950s, you know, losing the FA Cup finals and always wanting to get back there. And even the Busby babes were desperate for that day out at Wembley. So And in these days, Paddy, it is fair to say as well, these were the days where only one team won the league, so that team got into the European Cup. Yeah. A couple of teams got into the UEFA Cup. Trophies were significant. If you won the League Cup or you won the FA Cup, yes. The FA Cup in particular was, because it was the showstopper at the end of the season,
yeah.
it was in its way as big as the league. Not obviously not as important historically now, but in its own way as a day out and the face that everyone watched on TV, this was still the trophy to win, right?
Definitely. The crowds for matches leading up. I mean, now, you know, in 2022, we are talking in 2022, and the crowd, of course, you pack Wembley almost invariably for the final. But the crowds in previous rounds aren't as big. Well, an indication are that in the season we're talking about, crowds for FA Cup games are still virtually as big as league games. It still was comparable in importance with the league in winning it. It had in fact been more important. I think a lot of clubs way back in Busby's time, given the choice between the cup or the league, because of the cups had greater exposure through live television and so on, would probably have chosen the cup. Certainly Newcastle United would be a good example of that. They were the team of the 1950s because of FA Cup exploits. That wasn't quite the same in the season we were talking about, the middle of the 1970s. But it was bigger than it is today, and the, you know, the turnstiles proved that.
Yeah, it would be the BBC coverage in the morning starting at 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
I'm remembering we're jumping into the future with Mike Duxbury telling me a story about it was the 83 or the 85 cup final where the reporters would be hanging around asking what they were having for breakfast.
Yeah.
Kind of coverage all day. Yeah, and that was the way that people saw the FA Cup in the 70s as well. But
no, I can remember that, Wayne. I can remember closing the curtains so that the TV, you know, so that it was dark for the TV. I can remember closing the curtains at 9 a.m. exactly, and the there were cameras on the team bus and so on. And yeah, I can remember Arsenal being in a cup final once, and they were singing Irish songs because they had O'Leary and Pat Rice and Sammy Nelson and so on. And so there were that kind of insights there that you just don't get these days, you know.
Yeah, it was great as well. Obviously, football flooded with great characters in those days. The idea of towing the party line and saying things to be responsible with your profile wasn't exactly the flavour of the day. They could basically say what they like, and they often did. So talk about the league form first of all. Manchester United, having come back to the top flight, their consolidation basically centered around Doherty. Really liked the team they'd built. If there was one issue in there, he wasn't decided whether he wanted that hard man in midfield or a goal scorer up front. He wasn't, you know, there was one player missing from it. He felt there was something there. So the other problem was the squad depth. Obviously, Dave McCreary was basically like a one man fix all for every solution. If there was a problem at left back, McCreary would come on. If there was a problem at centre back, if there was a problem up front, it was always David McCreary. Mm-hmm. So he signed a couple of players in the summer, Colin Waldron and Alan Foggan. And these were two experienced players in terms of their league careers, but they were nowhere near good enough to push United onto the next level. And they both, we'll come on to it later when we go through the squad, had very, very short Manchester United careers. And neither of those players or anyone else really came in to dislodge this team in the early season. So it was pretty much the team that had gone through. We mentioned them in the last squad slide of the previous season. So it was Stepney, Nicolo Forsyth, Buchan, Greenough, Albiston, Houston, Coppell, Daly, McElroy, Hill, and Macari and Pearson. the youthful naivety in the early part of the season was pretty tough. I mean, United win just one in the first five league games. Everyone's looking forward to the cup games. First of all, the UEFA Cup. The first game that they play at Old Trafford is against Ajax, and they win that to overturn the first leg deficit. And then they play Juventus in the next round. They win at Old Trafford 1-0. Gordon Hill scores an incredible volley. And then in the second leg, Juventus absolutely tear them to school. This is a great Juventus team, the one that would go on to really dominate Italian football. And
yes, it was. I've got memories of this because this was my first season as a football reporter, 1976-7. And now my memory may be playing tricks, but I'm pretty sure that the first match I covered in Europe was Juventus against Man City. I think Juventus played City before they played United in that European run. And because I remember the team. If you don't mind indulging me on this, because it was so important. I mean, for me, it was pinch yourself time. I was living the dream. I was being sent to Turin to cover a team that had Dino Zoff in goal, Cucurella, Claudio Gentile was in the team, Morini was the centre half, the left back was one of the best left backs I've ever seen, Antonio Cabrini. The captain was a guy called Furino in midfield. They had Roberto Marco Tardelli, the man who patented goal celebrations in World Cup finals. They had Roberto Bettega, still a force at the club today. Boninsegna up front. I mean, it was... I don't want to spoil things here, but they went on to win the UEFA Cup that year. And with a team like that, they damn well should have done. So no disgrace, really, to United to get knocked out, and I'm pretty sure that I covered that game, and so it was a very special time for me, and that's why I remember that Juventus team. Anyway, back to Manchester United, because this is not what our listeners and viewers have tuned in for.
They'll be quite happy to know that they knocked out City before they knocked out United, which was true, obviously. United, I mean, the young kids did well enough to... So it was still, it was the beginning or the prime of this great Juventus side. And the Ajax team was it was post-Cruyff era. There's still some good players in that side, but definitely post-Cruyff, the breakup. There wasn't maybe two or three players in that squad remaining from the European Cup wins earlier in the decade. But the good thing for these United kids were that they kept the unbeaten home record, which had been going in Europe since the Busby days. So they beat Ajax at home, they beat Juventus at home. But in Turin, they were absolutely... They lost 3-0 and they were physically beaten as well by a really experienced side. And really, it's one of those where that team would have been looking... This United team would have been looking to sort of use that as a learning experience. The average age is 23 on that side, so they would be looking at taking the next level with that. Around the time of the Juventus defeat, United had a catastrophic run in the league where they lost 5-8. They didn't win in any of those 8 games, but that's mostly due to the injuries that they had, which really revealed the threadbare nature of this squad. You had Martin Buchan, who was missing for a key run again. And this, I mean, really, everyone will always do the romantic what if with this Doherty side. They'll always, and I'll indulge in that as much as anyone. They'll talk about how great was the potential, could they have won the league. But that run of games around the autumn really did expose, didn't it, Paddy? How really, if you lose one or two key players, the squad wasn't anywhere near strong enough to handle.
That's true. And although Foggen was a... Foggen in particular was an enormously talented player. His subsequent career was to prove that at the level to which United aspired, you know, he and Colin Waldron were not significant signings. And we've lavished praise on Doherty as to how he brought back the style and panache of the Busby era. There's no taking that away. But the team didn't kick on in the way in this season that we're talking about, in a way a third place at Wembley finish had suggested. No, it didn't.
So United were having to weather the storm. Excuse the terrible pun, because it was a storm which brought the final player that completed the Doherty jigsaw, Jimmy Green, off, signed from Stoke City because of a storm which had destroyed one of the stands at the Victoria Ground, as it was then. That's where Stoke played. The roof had been completely damaged, and the club needed to, they needed to raise funds, not necessarily to sell players. They would have probably liked to have kept hold of Jimmy Greenough, who was their legendary striker. He was going to go down as a club legend because of the things that he'd achieved there, and turning them into one of the great cup sides of the decade, after a good career at Leeds and Birmingham. But it was a pretty much opportunistic inquiry from Doherty to say, we'll take him off your hands, and Stoke's financial situation meant, well, that's the way that money could be raised to sort of save things in the short term. Not talking about Alan Foggan, really Jimmy Greenough wasn't that dissimilar in profile, right, in terms of the caliber of striker. Obviously Greenough was better than Foggan, I'm not disputing that, but in terms of the profile of the signing, he pretty much suited, he followed Waldron and Foggan in terms of,
I think that the difference with Jimmy Greenough was football brain. I mean, he had a fantastic football brain. And he wasn't probably a prolific scorer. I don't know what his numbers would be, but I remember him much more as a creator, a sort of, I suppose you could draw a comparison with Dalglish, somebody who other players could play off, because he had such good vision and technique, more than a goal scorer, more a Dalglish than a Rush, if you see what I mean. And he was a Manchester United player, if I can, use that sort of vague and undefined concept. Jimmy Greenough was a Manchester United player, and of course brother of Brian,
who'd come
through the United ranks to partner Martin Buchan in a pure footballing centre-back partnership.
You talk to anyone from that squad, they will rather generously, but I can see the point of what they're making. They say that Greenough had the Cantona effect on that team, and he kind of was like a talismanic figure that glued he was like calm around the chaos calm inside the chaos that was around him. United were playing at such a high tempo that, like you mentioned, he had the brain, he had the composure in there, not necessarily to slow things down, but to make sense of what was going on in the attack, and it made them a much more coordinated attacking team. And his arrival, I mean, the run of form, once he was settled into that front line, United won 5 on the bounce after the turn of the year. They won 8 from 9 in the league. So the form was definitely improving, taking them up from mid-table to sort of higher mid-table. They weren't gonna win the league. They weren't even going to challenge for the league, but they were hoping, like you said, for that cup run. Now that took complete precedence, especially after the defeat to Juventus in the UEFA Cup, and they were also eliminated fairly late stage, round 5 in the League Cup by Everton, an home defeat there. So all the eggs were in the FA Cup basket, and it was a strong start to that run. They defeated Walsall at home, QPR at home. Jimmy Greenough settled a replay against Southampton. They defeated Villa, who were League Cup winners, at home in the quarterfinal. They come up against Derby, Leeds United in the semi-final. And it's almost like in Manchester United history, the semi-finals in the FA Cup is the day for the wingers, right? The finals, not so much. They've never been a traditionally great day for United wingers, but in the semi-finals, they would traditionally make hay. Gordon Hills was the previous year, and it was Steve Coppell's this time round, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. he got the goal. Funnily enough, I was just thinking about your winger's theory. It can't be Wembley. It can't be something to do with Wembley, because one of the great heroic performances was John Aston in 1968. Mm. So, sorry, I was just wandering off piste there. Yes, Steve Coppell won the semi-final, took United back to Wembley, where, of course, they'd lost a year earlier.
Yeah, it was a great goal as well. Jimmy Greenough scoring the other goal on the day. Leeds, people may remember, I think it was Wilf McGuinness. It certainly was, wasn't it? But one of Wilf McGuinness's semi-finals, the FA Cup, the one where Best turned up late after... Well, he didn't turn up late, he turned up in his room with a girl, which is a different thing altogether. But so that one, I think that one went to two replays and it was settled by Billy Bremner. So we fast forward now, Leeds thinking, you know, obviously they're a physical side, still thinking that they'll have the match of United, and United coming out on top, Coppell having his day like he'll had the previous year. And it would be Liverpool waiting in the final. They were league champions. They'd just beaten United 1-0 at Anfield prior to the cup final, and they're also in the European Cup final as well. United went on to finish sixth in the league. Really, Paddy, talk me through what the final presented, because you look at this United side, I mentioned earlier, and you just poked a little bit of fun at it, the way that the Wembley pitch would be a graveyard for United's wingers, but also really, in a way, United's style of play. They couldn't play that way against Southampton, right? They tried to play this youthful way, but naivety got in the way of that. Yes. So it was more like, had they learned from that? Liverpool were obviously going to play this controlled, professional way. They had such a great way of closing games out, especially when they were in front. They could suffocate a game. And United, really, what they had to do is be economic with the way that they put this style of football, and they had to be professional in the way that they weren't used to being. And then they had to choose their times and the moments in which to employ this frenetic kind of.
Yeah, I mean, I hope exactly. I hope it's not an exaggeration to say that United went back to Wembley as probably almost as great an underdog as Southampton had been the year before.
Yeah,
I mean, this Liverpool team was a. Well, you just explained it earlier. They just won the league. They'd beaten United at, albeit only 1-0, just a week or two before, I think. Yeah. They were about to, you know, hoping to be crowned the champions of Europe. I mean, they were a fantastic team. Arguably better, more sophisticated than they had been under Shankly, under Paisley. And so United weren't, my recollection is that United weren't given much of a chance. After all, this is a United team that's only, two, 3 years out of the second division, you know, and still very much a work in progress. So United were going to need something special or something unusual to beat Liverpool. And actually, they did, but not the prettiest goal.
No, I think what really counted for United, in a way, was that Liverpool had just about won the league anyway. And yes. I think it was won by a draw, but after they defeated United, they didn't win again in the league. They drew three and they lost the last one. So all the momentum had gone, you know, from... because they'd won the league quite convincingly in the end. By a single point, but it had been secured earlier than that. So they were coasting. They probably did a little bit like United the previous season, probably not took it for granted, but were resting on their laurels as in their position as favourites. They thought that it'd be a lot more easier to navigate. Obviously, United had the... not necessarily momentum, but they had this drive that they didn't want to be beaten again from the previous season. You had a lot of players really switched on to the concentration of their performance, because if there'd been any accusations that had lapsed against Southampton, they couldn't afford for that to happen against Liverpool. It definitely wasn't the greatest of finals in the first half, but United, you can read a lot into a singular victory and a singular performance. But one thing that seemed to be the case, or seemed to be evident from that 90 minutes, Paddy, is that United were realising, right, it's good to be gung-ho and destroy teams the way that we have done and play our natural way. But I wouldn't go as far as saying it was conservatism or pragmatism, but there was an element of knowing, all right, we need to be more respectful of the opponents that we're playing against.
Yes.
Be more aware of the danger that we suffer from, because this United team did have naivetes in there and they did have flaws. They were sort of learning from that as they were growing, which obviously is a sign of the experience that they were picking up. And this game was a great example of that, wasn't it? Because, I mean, if you look, the standout performances were from Buchan and Greenough in defence.
Uh-huh. Yes, very much so. But after, it was a dull first half, and basically United seized the momentum, then they lost it, but then they got it back again. All three goals in the match came in a five-minute period. United took the lead. We spoke in the previous episode about the impact Stuart Pearson had. And he had a very important impact on this game by giving United the lead. It was a long ball forward and a classic finish, a low drive past Clemens, I guess it was. Yeah. It was Clemens. I'm just looking at my notes. And the important task then was to hold on to that lead, consolidate, no chance. Liverpool equalised with another good goal, a sort of half volley by Jimmy Case, or hit the ball on the up. No chance for Stepney. So that's 1-1. But United still had that sense of adventure. And then they scored the goal that I referred to earlier, a bit bizarre. Can you remember it well enough to describe it? I've got notes here, but all I remember is I didn't know who'd scored it. I just saw the ball in the net.
McCarry
who shot, yeah.
Yeah. And it comes off the midriff of Jimmy Greenough. Now, you can look back at the replay, that shot is definitely going wide from McCarry. Much as he wants to claim it's going in, it definitely isn't. But it diverts off Greenough's midriff, and because of that, it completely catches Clemens off guard, and the ball flies into the net. Even when you look at it, it is almost like fate is directing that ball in, because you can't really see how the ball can generate that much power and momentum from a midriff. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even then, you would think it should direct somewhere else, but no, it flies into the net. And I think that is United. Again, you're only looking at this 90 minutes in isolation, so you can only look at it and say this is somewhat of a conclusion from that. But it did seem like United inputted this kind of frenzy. They knew that this is a five-minute spell that they could take advantage of while the game was not settled, as long as they used that kind of energy, which they were used to doing to more effect against weaker opposition. But they'd employed it here. It kind of won out. And then from that moment on, after McCarry scored, after Greenough scored, that's one of the viewers coming in. They'll both clear, they both do. But it's definitely Greenough's goal. Without question. You don't need the committee for that one. But after Greenough puts the ball in with his lower torso, United... They do something that they've never done before, which is employ all that, the experience that they have been picking up. They show this kind of professionalism. The defending is outstanding. You need McCarry and McIlroy in the middle to keep pace with that midfield, because really they don't have a defensive instinct between them, but they really have to show some in the second half of this game, the last 30 minutes for sure, because Liverpool squeeze the nettle. They look like they're going to come back and get an equaliser, but United really put in this mature performance. Buchan is incredible, one of his best performances, but it's by far Brian's best performance. He ends up being named man of the match. It's an upset, Paddy, for sure, because Liverpool are heavy favourites. A lot of United fans and a lot of this team look at this game as evidence that United could have progressed to the next level. And obviously, we saw what's to follow. There's a quick breakup of this side in a way, which we'll come on to in a moment. But we'll talk. I just want to pick your brains on the potential of this side. Is this result symptomatic of something greater in the future for United that could have been there, or do you think it's just like the Southampton game, a one-off that United rose to the occasion and they rode the luck at the end?
I kind of think it's very, very difficult to predict what would have happened, but I think winning a trophy at the end of a season where they'd slipped from third to sixth in the league was significant. And particularly winning a trophy by beating Liverpool. That was a sign that Manchester United, were back.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Everybody talks about Manchester United 1999. Well, if Liverpool had managed to overcome Manchester United in this game, Liverpool would have won that treble of European Cup, League and Cup. So, yeah, it was a terrific feat, and it signaled that although it was a time of regression in the league, as I said earlier, that Manchester United were back lifting trophies, and that was significant. So I think that had fate not intervened, that one game would have saved Manchester United's season. Just one thing on the team, a detail on the team. Unless I'm very much mistaken, the absence of Gerry Daly is significant. And I think Lou Macari had by then moved back into midfield to allow Greenough and Stuart Pearson to be the front two. That was another development. And yes, there was class all the way through. Jimmy Nicol had taken over from Alex Forsyth, and I think, by and large, was an improvement. I mean, not that Alex Forsyth was a decent player, but that was and at left back, another change. Again, I think it might have been a slight improvement. Was Arthur Alberston better than Forsyth? Stuart Houston. But both very good players. But Arthur, perhaps more of a specialist fullback.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Houston, he was injured, broke his leg a couple of weeks before the final against Bristol City on a hard pitch. Everyone blamed the pitch for that. Alberston definitely more of a left back. Houston could play across the middle as well, couldn't he?
Yeah.
Alberson could definitely join in the attack as well. Not that there would be much cause for him when, Gordon's not going to come back on that side at all. Incidentally, Gordon complained about his performances in both finals. He wasn't happy with them. If you watch him back, he's actually quite disciplined in the second final, even though he does come off near the end for McCreary. But I think he was brought off in both finals, and he always felt like, that was reflective of his performance in there, which is a little bit unfair to himself. But, you know, it was determined, that game, by the defence and the midfield and the work rate there. You mentioned fate. Put up the team picture, the celebration picture again for those who are watching on the video, because there's some fair significance by the man stood next to Tommy Docket.
There is. I mean, the team is shown, for those who don't have the pictures, the team's shown celebrating with the cup, wearing caps and scarves that fans have thrown onto the pitch. And the coaching staff and ancillary staff are there. Tommy Docherty, naturally and rightly prominent, wearing a kipper tie, and his coaching staff around him, including Tommy Cavanagh. I think that might be Frank Blunston there, who was also on the coaching staff. But right next, shoulder to shoulder with Tommy, standing in the back row of this team pictures of celebrating players and coaches, is the physiotherapist, Laurie Brown. Tommy and Laurie Brown and Tommy Cavanagh were a familiar sight together. They were great mates. And, you know, often I can remember as a young reporter, perhaps going to an away game or something like that, and you would, in the hotel lobby, you'd often find the three of them sharing a pot of tea and a natter and being ready to natter to anybody who went past. However, this friendship was to be placed under unbearable strain.
Well,
do you want me to tell you why?
Yeah, in fact, it might be better coming from you.
Right. Well, I'll go consult my book, because it was a very sensitive matter. Tommy Docherty was married and had been married for a long time to Agnes, his wife, and Laurie's wife was Mary. And Tommy fell in love with Mary Brown, his friend's wife. And when this was disclosed in the newspapers, Manchester United clearly had a decision to make. When it was announced, when the affair was made public and it became clear that it wasn't just an affair, and that Mary and Tommy would move in together, leaving Agnes and Laurie, United as a club had a decision to make, whether to sack Tommy, first of all. Clearly, Tommy and Laurie Brown could no longer work together or be friends. And at first it looked, and Tommy Docherty actually paid tribute to the club, by Chairman Louis Edwards, Matt Busby, still a power behind the throne. He paid tribute to the club by saying, United have said I can keep my job, and I thank them for that. However, the debate, the moral debate, or the decision about what to do about the moral dilemma, the debate shifted. Now, a lot of factors are said to have conspired in this. One was Matt's attitude, and perhaps even more importantly, that of Matt's wife. Bear in mind that, you know, Christian Catholic morality was a powerful factor in both of their lives. Jean Busby was said to have argued very vociferously that what had happened to Tommy and Laurie could only be one outcome, and that was that Tommy should actually lose his job, because it would have been immoral for Laurie to have done so, as the, as it were, innocent party. in what had happened. And gradually that became what would happen. And Tommy was in fact wrong, and he did lose his job. And that was it. You know, everything seemed to be going very much in the right direction for Manchester United. But once again, they were on the lookout for a new manager.
Yeah. The players insisted that they knew nothing about the affair, and they were caught cold by news of the sack as well. There was one of the greatest stories, I think it's humorous in the way that it's told. Sammy McElroy was on holiday, and he was relaxing in the sea on an airbed, having the time of his life, just sort of chilling, FA Cup winner. You know, one of the, well, the last Busby babe. Now he's got a trophy. Finally feels like he's in the United team that, you know, is worthy of the name. When a fella pops up next to him in the sea, comes up beneath the airbed in a snorkel and a mask, pops up. Hi, Sammy. It's Gordon Hill. Gordon Hill has swum up. He had no idea he was going to be there, but he's spotted him. Gordon spotted him, and he swam out to see him. And he goes, "You're not going to believe this. Doc's been sacked." So that's how they found out. That's how Sammy found out that he was in the sea in Ibiza. The players were by and large caught cold by it. They all insisted they knew nothing about it. It's one of those like retrospective, like, oh, that's why Tommy was absent sometimes at the team meeting, you know, and that's why Tina Laurie was there and stuff like that. It was a moral dilemma. I think it was one of those where you couldn't really see any other way for the club to carry on, because it was the dignified thing, the right thing. They couldn't have sacked Laurie Brown, even though most people said, well, you can find another physio, and maybe even Laurie himself would have been fine with that. And the compensation that he might have got in lieu of continuing. But Laurie did continue, Tommy didn't. And then the question then turns to like a what if, doesn't it? What could this United team have achieved? They were only 23. I mean, the comparison I always make is that the composition of that side is almost identical to the fledgling side of the Fergie fledglings of 1996. You've got an experienced goalkeeper, Schmeichel, Stettner, an experienced forward, Cantona, and then the rest of the side is youthful in, you know, and learning along the way. You know, they're picking up the odd defeat against the experienced sides, but they're learning from them all the time. And that's the big question with this side. How great could they have been? We'll come into how quickly they broke apart as a side and with the individuals in subsequent episodes, but the fact remains that this was the pinnacle of this side together. It would turn out to be the 1977 side. So whether or not you could say that they could have beaten this amazing Liverpool side, let's say, as well, this is one of the greatest in their history at the start of their, I mean, this is their 10th league title, so it's the beginning of their real strong period of dominance. So whether or not they could have been better than them is one question. But the more pertinent point is, could they have been the main challengers in the way that Aston Villa and Nottingham Forest, who were in the second division with them, let's not forget that they could have won a league title like one of those two teams did, like they could have won the European Cup like one of those two teams did. And that's a fair enough and a strong enough what if. But you would have to then, you're delving into all the other things. I mean, the first thing is you look at the hit rate of Doherty's signings. They weren't increasingly good. You know, like a great manager who's been there for a long period of time, their sense of quality of signings tends to improve. You know, the hit rate, the success rate of those players they bring in tends to be sound, whereas Doherty's was as unpredictable as ever. He brought in Waldron and Foggan, and they were gone straight away. Greenough was obviously a massive success, but that's still one in three senior signings. You know, not a guarantee that if he did bring in two or three more signings to flesh out the squad, to give a more, let's say, for example, the the improvements that people would say this United team needed was some steel in defence, some steel in midfield, and some steel up front. Basically, a lot of physicality through the side, which was needed, which they didn't have, which could compensate or help bring on that inexperience to the next level. So the what ifs are there. I mean, hopefully through the 5 years of the Doherty era, which we've covered, we've given enough tributes to and plaudits to the way that that team played football to give it its own sort of space to speak for itself. I know that Tommy was never really, you and I both talked to him in later life, he was never really, there was a period after his sacking where he would come out and he'd be critical of his successors, and he would, you know, he was renowned as a bitter old man because of that. But I know that you and I both talked to him in his later years. It wasn't necessarily the case. And he wouldn't always talk with any great philosophical depth about his style of football. He liked you thinking that it was off the cuff. I often talked to him. I said like I wanted to give his team a little bit more credit because the fact of the matter is, Paddy, and you will know this better than I do because you lived through most of it in a more conscious way. Because of the nature of the way that he left the club, a lot of what Tommy did was almost airbrushed from history, wasn't it, really?
Yes.
If you want of a better phrase, effectively, not for those who knew, but the club rarely acknowledged it in a full way in the way that they did the Busby era.
That's right. For different reasons. I mean, you could draw a comparison with the way George Graham's achievements were sort of airbrushed at Arsenal because he was accused, lost his job, you know, after a bungs scandal. I hasten to add that the former Manchester United and Arsenal player George Graham was a bit unlucky in that he was caught and others weren't, but certainly Arsenal took that sort of airbrushing attitude to George, and still to an extent do. Man United, the same with Tommy Doherty. But, you know, I think when Tommy died, we're now talking in 2022, and then Tommy died, was it last year? Or
I think New Year's Eve 2020.
Yes. And I think he was given a bit more credit for his footballing contribution. It's also worth saying that it's a moot point about whether what happened was bad. I mean, Tommy and Mary were together until Tommy's death.
Yeah.
And, you know, for many, many years and decades of love afterwards. So, you know, it would be a hard heart that would... That would still consider it a scandal, or I'm sure Laurie Brown might have his views on that. But I think to return to the footballing point that you raised, I think at the time of his death he was given a proper credit for that. You said before that I might have experienced a bit more. I found Tommy, although easy. Hail fellow well met and a witty, amusing and smile inducing man. It was quite difficult to get him to talk in any depth about his own footballing achievements. He would always veer off into a wisecrack or a barb against, as you say, one of his successors. He was the sort of the anti-Wilf, wasn't he? Whereas Wilf could never say a word against Manchester United. Tommy wasn't of that view, but he was a wonderful manager, and from footballing point of view, it is sad that we never got to find out how good a Manchester United manager he could be. He had, after all, you know, he'd had a good, he was a very good manager of Chelsea for about 5 or 6 years before. Bizarrely resigning and turning up at Rotherham. It was a strange career in many ways.
Yeah, he ended up, he'd go to Derby after this, and then he'd go to Australia. Yeah, it was. He's funny guy.
I think also you spoke to somebody, a player that he signed. I can't remember who it was, who was very keen to stress that he wasn't just personality. He didn't just create a bubbling, effervescent team in his own image. That his technical advice to players was very, very astute as well. You know, he was a student of the game as well as a jovial practitioner of it.
You would get that with there are certain players, they would call them Doherty loyalists, right? They were like three or four players, more than three or four, but they were players who, you see, was like Marmite, basically. There were a lot of players who didn't really like his abrasive way, and a lot of players who were completely charmed by him, and those who were charmed by him would see that sort of the philosophical side of him. They'll say it was a lot more measured than people would give credit for. It was funny because the last couple of years, obviously the last sort of 10 years, almost everything to do with my writing. I was certainly at the start when I was writing books.
Yeah,
a lot of them were concentrating on the Doherty era. Like, so I was working with Brian. I've worked with three. The biographies of three of that FA Cup winning side I've been fortunate enough to write.
Yeah.
Sam, Brian and Gordon. And three of those loyalists, by the way, it should be said, they were absolute Doherty disciples. And when I was writing the book on the second division season, when I was writing the Too Good to Go Down, the film that we did that you were in as well, I was always at pains to tell Tommy, like, oh, I really hope that, you know, I'm doing a lot of work here that I really want to try and make sure that people of this generation and an older generation know that we're turning the clock back a little bit and giving you the respects that you deserve for the job that you did. I know it's a bit late in the day for you. And he was like, you know, obviously long in the tooth. He didn't really care. Skin like a rhino. And I just thought, you know, I'm doing it for my own pleasure then, Tommy. I'm doing it for me and I like doing it. But then when after the film came out, we were sat watching the film with him in the screening that we had in Manchester. I was sat next to him and I was like always looking across at him, you know, like, are we doing himself justice? I mean, he was laughing along with it. Even when the players who were having a little bit of a dig at him, like Willie Morgan and Jim McAleog, when they were having a little bit of a dig, he was laughing along with it. And at the end, he applauded. And the last time I saw him, I took him a few copies of the book along. So obviously the book and the film came together. Yeah. And he signed my copy. I didn't see it until I'd left. But he in my copy of the book, he wrote, "Thanks for everything." I thought, you wily old git. You know, it got me quite emotional that, like, all that work I'd done over all those years, that it actually did mean something to him.
Yeah.
And he was like that. He could catch you out a little bit. I can see why a lot of people were fond of him. But yeah,
I certainly was, Wayne. I liked him a lot. He was generous with his time and his spirit.
Yeah. Let's run through the squad very quickly, see how quickly we can do this. The goalkeeper's Alex Stepney, 57 games. So he's definitely ending the Doherty era as first choice. 57, 40 in the league. Paddy Roach made the other two league appearances, and they were the only two that he made all season. Arthur Albiston, 25 appearances in all competitions, 17 of those in the league, and obviously in the FA Cup final. Martin Buchan missed some games, but he played 46 in all competitions, 33 in the league. Alex Forsyth, like you mentioned earlier, had lost his place to Jimmy Nicol, now made five appearances, four of those in the league. Brian Greenough, definitely first choice alongside Martin, 57 appearances, the most of any outfield player, five goals, three goals in 40 in the league. Stuart Houston, left back, five goals in 51 appearances, three in 36 in the league. Jimmy Nicol, one in 55 in all competitions and no goals. 39 league appearances. That brings us on to Steve Patterson. Played in defence and up from a teenager nicknamed Pelle in the youth team, but he played as a centre-back for United. I don't know if there are many centre-halves who have been called Pelle in their time. He signed from Highland.
Steve Patterson could. It was, I think, originally a centre-forward, or he was one of those. who could play centre forward or centre half. Hence, I think I don't know if the Pele was ironic, but he was he could play as well.
His first appearance, he actually signed from Highland League club Nairn County. First appearance for United came as a sub for Gordon Hill as Tommy Doherty went conservative to try and close the game out against Ajax with 15 minutes to go. Little bit of history here. It was the first time ever that a second substitute was used in a game for United, and Steve was that second substitute. The other new defender for this season was Colin Waldron, as we mentioned earlier. He was a centre-half signed really to play in the reserves there as senior backup. He played for Bury, Chelsea, and most notably Burnley. He played 300 league games and being club captain at Turf Moor, but he'd been released by them in the summer. He wasn't at the club. He played these four appearances at the very early start of this season with Martin Buchan's injury. He played in a 4-0 defeat at West Brom, and then Sunderland signed him from United before Christmas. At the midfield, Jonathan Clark made only one appearance, and no, that's not an extra from the set of Grangell. Jonathan Clark, he definitely looks like he's
a visual joke, but you can work it. Those without the pictures can work that one out.
Midfielder, he made his debut age just 17, Swansea born. Just this one appearance as a substitute against Sunderland in November. He was a twice-capped Welsh schoolboy who joined as a trainee in March 1975. But yeah, just this one substitute appearance for the club. Steve Coppell, first choice on the right, 8 goals in 56, 6 in 40 in the league. Gerry Daly, as you mentioned, lost his place due to the signing of Jimmy Greenough, 7 in 28 in all competitions, 4 in 17 in the league. Tommy Jackson, who signed last season, plays just 3 games, 2 of those in the league. David McCreary, 24 substitute appearances in his 37 appearances, 2 goals in 25 league games, 16 of those from the bench. Chris McGrath, a central midfielder and also a winger as well. He used to play for Spurs, a winger at Spurs, more of a midfielder at United. So highly rated by Tommy Doherty that Tommy drove to Scotland in his Mercedes to meet the family. He said he was one of those who said Tommy sometimes gets portrayed as a joker in the dressing room, but he wasn't like that. He worked really hard with all the players, made sure we all knew our roles and how best we could carry them out. And he was methodical. By the time it came to match days, we didn't need any big tactical discussions before the kickoff. Tommy and all his colleagues had done the planning and preparation beforehand. He was one of those people who made us all feel special. Signed for 30,000, played only 7 games this season, 6 of those in the league, 5 of those 7 from the bench. Sammy McElroy, 57 appearances, 1 of those from the bench, 3 goals, 2 in 40 in the league. You got Alan Foggan then, one of those signings that we mentioned at the start of the season. He won schoolboy sprinting competitions, so he was a definite rapid forward. Came through the ranks at Newcastle, where he scored in their 1969 Fairs Cup win. Played 115 league games for Middlesbrough and scored 45 goals. He was signed for United from Hartford by St. Ten Hills in the US for around £40,000 in July, but played just 3 games, 2 of them, ironically enough, against Newcastle and Middlesbrough, before he was sold to Sunderland for £25,000, becoming one of the few players to represent all 3 big North East clubs. Sorry, Darlington fans, you know what I'm talking about. I'm not trying to offend anyone with that. Gordon Hill, the other winger, 22 goals in 56 games, 15 in 39 in all competitions. Lou Macari in the front line, 14 goals in 53 in all competitions, 9 in 38 in the league. Stuart Pearson, 19 in 53 and 15 in 39 in the league. And that brings us on nicely to Jimmy Greenough, the Eric Cantona of this team. 30 years of age when he was signed, bags of experience, a club legend at Stoke. But again, as you said earlier, Paddy, not a tall striker, not likely to get you more than 20 goals. But his footballing brain and his composure and his sense of timing made him perfect player for this Doherty team. United's colours this season were red, white and black. The away kit was still that white one with black stripes. Admiral and Adidas had actually been in dispute over the pre-season about this. Originally, Admiral had released the kit with three stripes, but that was the trademark of Adidas. So Admiral had to put a fourth stripe on. Eventually, they came to a settlement where Admiral paid Adidas some money and they took the fourth stripe off, so they went back to three. A merchandiser's dream to sell three versions of the same strip for sure. And United's third kit this season was like the home one, same design, but it was a blue shirt with white shorts and black socks. The United review was this. They've changed the cover again, this time with these graphics on. If you just can see, if you're watching the video version, it's got a Mount Rushmore-style Tommy Docker and Alex Stepney in goal, and there's poor old in the scarf up, and a non-specific midfielder on the ball there. It looks like it could be Lou McCorry, also could be Chris McGraw, as we went through showed earlier.
It could be pretty well anyone, actually, couldn't it? Oh, happy Christmas.
Yeah, we got the Christmas version up as well. We've got Santa in football boots and United socks, but he's still got his jacket on, of course, because he would want to wear the jacket because it'd be pretty nippy at Christmas. Let's have a look. The average attendance at Old Trafford up by 100 to 53,390. Elsewhere in football, Liverpool won the league, the 10th title, the European Cup for the first time, and Villa won the League Cup. That's it for this episode, guys. United win the FA Cup but lose their manager, Tommy Docherty. How will they fare in the post-Docherty era? We will be back to cover that, whoever the successor may be. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please give it a like and a subscribe on the YouTube channel. And join in the comment section, as always. If you're listening back on the audio platform, please give us a like and a subscription and a review on the platform you're listening on. We will be back next time. Stay safe, stay well.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.